Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by Bruegel's Nicolas Véran and Jim Fries. Jim is a former head of FinCEN, the U.S. Treasury's anti-money laundering unit, and also worked at Deutsche Börse in Frankfurt as an organization that had to report about what they were doing to prevent money laundering. And it is with that we enter in today's conversation about the new anti-money laundering agency in the European Union. This is a big deal to have a new EU-wide agency. It's based in Frankfurt. It's getting up and running. It's doing some harmonizing. It will have a little bit of a direct oversight role. And it's a big step forward in the EU's grand financial integration project. Nicolas, you've been working on these issues for a long time. How big a deal is it that we have an AMLA now, and what have been the challenges since it's set up?
Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks for having me. Indeed, AMLA, the anti-money laundering authority of the European Union, is a big deal. It's a new agency, as you said, a new agency. So the legal technology is Article 114 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. That's a single market article. So that's the way many EU agencies are set up, like EBA, EIOPA, ESMA in the financial domain for the acronym lovers. AMLA is the first time that the EU gives itself a tool at the EU level to really tackle AML in a coordinated way. Previously, they only had directives about anti-money laundering requirements enforced at the national level. The directive itself had to be transposed into national law. It was all very scattered. And in anti-money laundering, in fighting against financial crime and financial malpractice, the cliche, which is also true, is that the system is only as strong as the weakest link. So when you have 27 member states, there's a likelihood that one or two of them are really not at the best practice level, and then you have a very weak system overall. So that's why AMLA, the establishment of AMLA is so important. We'll discuss how it works, whether it meets the objective of making the system more robust, but it really was a milestone and frankly a complete change of scenery in terms of anti-money laundering action in the European Union, in my view. And as you said, it's been created by law in 2024. It started operations in 25. Now they are not entirely up and running. They're still hiring a lot, and they will be entirely up and running in early 2028. So we have this sequence of establishment.
Jim, what does a government agency need to do to keep track of money laundering and all the things that companies ought to do to prevent it?
So I guess if I could just step back and add on to what Nicolas said, but to put it in a little bit of a broader context. Yes, fundamentally, it is a major step and critical and an inevitable step in the common market, and not just in terms of an economic area, but certainly when you have a single currency in most of the relevant member states, that if you as a consumer can have a bank account, that the goal is, although not fully realized yet, that you could pay and send funds in the same way across different member states, then you need to have a harmonized anti-money laundering framework, because any way that funds can move, any way the value can be intermediated, it can be abused by criminals. But one of the themes I want to flag right now, and something I'll come back to, as Nicola correctly described, the setting up of the AMLA uses some of the same legal basis and with the new regulation and framework and structure, and that's part of your question related to the governance, for the other financial services oversight entities, EBA, ESMA, EIOPA. But AMLA also goes into a new area in the work of the financial intelligence unit. So not only the supervision of the obliged entities that a regulated bank is following the rules with respect to it, which is frankly the role of supervision and oversight for other entities, but it goes into the area of police powers, justice ministries, areas that are not harmonized across the European Union. Role of the financial intelligence unit fundamentally is to take information from the financial sector about potential abuses and make them available to law enforcement for prosecution. So it's really this bridging aspect. And fundamentally, I think the most important thing to not forget, probably less that is talked about because from the perspective of the regulated entities, you have a more narrow focus. But for the success of the entity in establishing it, it is not just to have a check the box exercise. Are banks largely the focus following the rules? But is it truly hampering the ability of criminals to abuse the system? And is it allowing the prosecutors and law enforcement authorities to follow up and hold the criminals accountable? That will be the ultimate test. And that's a long time down the road before we'll know whether there's true success in that area.
So how does that work? Can you, for people who are new to this area, can you give an example of what it is that all these agencies are trying to stop?
So what they're trying to stop is fairly simple, or what they're trying to allow and then, again, avoid the abuses. When you come down to the basic principles, the anti-money laundering requirements are really pretty simple. Very different if we were talking about some aspects of market risk or credit risks and covariances and trying to worry about Six Sigmas and the like of market movements. Fundamentally, you're coming down to knowing who your customer is. And for corporate entities, that means who's behind the name in front of you, and then monitoring their activity to see that it's consistent with what you would expect for that profile. And if you find something that's inconsistent with that activity, it could be because there's been a victim of fraud, somebody's hacked into somebody's account, or there's internal abuse of an insider, or it could be a circumstance where someone who purports to be doing a certain activity is trying to abuse the system and move money for criminal purposes or hide the source of funds. And that second aspect of the vigilance. So first, again, the financial institution had to be vigilant to know their customer. The second aspect is when they see evidence that's suspicious, that doesn't make economic sense, doesn't fit for that partner, they report it to the financial intelligence unit. The financial intelligence unit analyzes that with the benefit of other aspects, other government databases, as well as publicly available information, and then makes referrals to law enforcement to try to go ahead with an investigation, and if they believe that there's criminal activity, eventual prosecution. That's really what it breaks down to, the fundamental aspect. The rest of it is details, how we work on that, or looking at specific higher risk aspects, such as corruption among public officials, or a new aspect that after the World Cup, we can't not talk about, that football clubs will also be involved in the anti-money laundering authority, something you don't normally think of with respect to banks, but I think everyone is aware of the amount of money and potential for abuse and corruption involved in high-level sports.
Nicolas, why does Europe specifically need to up its game on this?
Well, because the game was not very good. And part of why the game was not very good is actually the single market. So when you have a country with its own currency, financial borders, all that, they can do everything in the country and keep things, at least in principle, more or less under control. When you have the single market, money moves across borders within the single market completely seamlessly. And then a country's institutions, even if they're very good, can nothing against malpractice that is done from other parts of the single market. As I said, the system is only as strong as its weakest link. When the European Commission was doing its consultations for the legislation that led to the creation of AMLA in the early 2020s, they invited an Italian prosecutor who was speaking in Italian from Catanzaro. Catanzaro is in Calabria. It is one of the hotspots of crime in Europe, organized crime. And he was speaking literally from the fortress. You could feel the temperature, if I can put it there. And I'm sorry to propagate clichés about Southern Italy, but that was very much what he was talking about. And what he said was, the single market has been great for the criminals, not for me, not for us prosecutors, because they can take advantage of this porosity of this open borders in a way that we cannot. So this is the imbalance, the asymmetry that AMLA is there to fix, to offset. If we have an enforcement, a monitoring, a supervision of financial crime at the European level, at the scale where financial criminals operate, will do better in addressing financial crime. That's the promise of AMLA. Now, of course, there are two things to mention. One is it's not just the European Union. There's a broader world out there, and we'll discuss that, how AMLA will not only do its work within the European Union or the European Economic Area, to be precise, but also in a global environment where criminality has become extremely globalized. Also, Russia is next door. That's part of the landscape that we're talking about. The other one, and by the way, I hope, Jim, that we'll discuss sanctions evasion and things that have to do with financial sanctions, where there is a lot of overlap with financial crime and financial integrity. The other thing is to go a bit more into the technical stuff that Jim presented. There are really two different sides of AMLA's activity, and actually that is mirrored in the way they're organized. There is what the jargon refers to as AML supervision, which is an administrative activity. And this is making sure that the financial intermediaries or other firms involved, including, by the way, football clubs, so they're called obliged entities in the AML jargon, making sure that the obliged entities have an AML program. They know their customers, they know how to report suspicious activity, and they do that when the suspicious activity arises. So that's a supervisory activity. It's making sure the obliged entities have an AML program and comply with the AML program. And it is administrative. It has many analogies with other areas of financial supervision. One twist is that it's not only hitting regulated entities, it's also applicable to obliged entities that are unregulated financial firms or indeed non-financial firms, such as, you know, art galleries, football clubs, lawyers and accountants, all kinds of different intermediaries, real estate agents, you name it. The other side of AMLA's activity, and Jim mentioned that, is what has to do with what the jargon calls financial intelligence units, FIUs. FIUs are very important in the global AML framework. Every country in the world, in principle, I'm not sure that's completely right, Jim, but by and large, every country in the world has one and only one FIU. So it's a designated unit of the state that is the place where obliged entities report suspicious activity. And then the FIU report that or transmit that to the law enforcement authorities, prosecutors, police, what have you, to the extent needed when there is a case. And the decision that was made with the creation of AMLA was to create European AML supervisors that would work with national AML supervisors in an architecture which is not completely unlike what we have in banking, prudential supervision, or in competition authorities. So a hub and spokes architecture where you have a system that brings together the national authorities and the European authority, in that case, AMLA. But then in FIU, it's a different architecture because AMLA is not an FIU. So the, as I said, a jurisdiction has one and only one FIU. And the policy choice we have now is that this remains at the national level in the EU. So there are 27 FIUs in the EU, 30 if you count the three countries of the European Economic Area, and AMLA is there to coordinate them, to make them work better, to build better information systems, which of course is of critical importance. But at this point, the EU has not taken the step, which was debated, but not taken, I think rightly not taken, by the way, at this stage, but we can discuss that, to create a single FIU with AMLA. So I think the architecture really needs to be understood. AMLA is a European AML supervisor, not a single supervisor, because it works in a system with national AML supervisors, which themselves are many inside each country, because we you have many types of obliged entities. And AMLA separately and in relation to that is a hub, a facilitator, a coordination device for national FIUs that remain in the European Union. Sorry, that was a bit long, but I think very important to understand the architecture.
Yeah, very much so. And I have a follow-up question on that. My understanding is that starting from 2028, they'll have a list of about 40 entities that they will be directly overseeing. And also, to your other point, that they will be working with councils in each of the member states, and that there is a fair amount of disparity between the quality of those councils and how they go together, and that trying to get that organized is another one of their tough tasks. Is that a way to think about what they're doing?
So you're right. I mean, if you compare with banks, so the for example, prudential supervision of banks, the ECB has direct supervision of about 100 plus banking groups. And then it has what is called supervisory oversight, which is actually quite, it's a powerful toolkit to make sure national authorities supervise bit less than 2,000 other banks in the Eurozone. So if you take those orders of magnitude, AMLA will have 40 entities under its direct supervision, and it's currently working at the selection of those entities, building the methodologies and then collecting the data on which it would select the 40. There will be a lot of judgment. They have a lot of discretion, actually, because it's considered risk-based selection. So it's not just mechanical quantitative indicators. And Jim will, I'm sure, have something to say about that. And then you have not just, 2,000, but actually a much larger number. I don't even know the number, if it's in the tens or hundreds or thousands or millions, but a very vast scope of other obliged entities, which in principle are subject to AML supervision in the European Union. And this is financial entities and non-financial entities, as I said. So it's a very vast area. So AMLA will be tested on both sides. The direct supervision, which is very important because it means that if the national system doesn't deliver, AMLA can take over. And they have to establish the fact that they have this capacity. Again, it's risk-based, so very different from the single supervisory mechanism, where the dividing line between European and national supervision is basically quantitative. If you have more than 30 billion euro in total assets, you go to the ECB. If you have less, generally you stay at the national level, with some exceptions. Here, AMLA can go to your small mom-and-pop asset manager if they think that there is risk there, and it's more than just mom and pop. But also, there's a supervisory oversight. I'm not sure if they call it that way in AMLA, but the fact that AMLA has to check the way national authorities do their work, and in each country, they have actually several national authorities. That's why there is much more complicated coordination than, for example, in banking supervision, because it's typically not the same authorities that looks at banks and at asset managers, at lawyers, at real estate agents, or at football clubs. So you have a very complex system, lots and lots and lots of partners that AMLA will need to manage inside the EU, and we have not even started discussing the international connections.
Maybe just add one more aspect in terms of a critical buzzword to understanding that, which Nicola did not yet mention, and that is to have a single rule book. And again, this is the same framework that the European Central Bank, with a single supervisory mechanism, has set up. There's one rule book for the banking supervision. The ECB takes essentially the largest entities, 100 plus, directly supervises them, but then the member state supervisors are following the same rule book under an oversight of the European Central Bank. The same framework is essentially what we're looking at here with AMLA. I guess that's an important thing to understand overall. Although this is a new entity, they have a lot of challenges being set up. The goals, what we're trying to achieve, the aspect of the expectations for FIUs are set out in United Nations conventions from a generation ago. What's expected in AML supervision is well understood and implemented around the world in principle. The question is now mostly one of harmonization. But as Nicola correctly said, it's a huge aspect of harmonization, not only for AMLA, but something I'll come back to later if you let me, resources and reasonable expectations. It's frankly a drain on the member state resources in helping to set up AMLA before we will turn around and see positive public benefits.
Transitions are hard. In the next part of our podcast, I do want to take a minute to talk about the United States and the developments there that have really changed how anti-money laundering works around the world. It first popped up on my radar anyway after the September 11th, 2001 attacks, when we saw all kinds of sanctions from the US against people who were associated with Al-Qaeda in various ways. And then over time, the US financial reporting apparatus turned also to tax evasion, and there was a lot of effort to track down people who owned foreign bank accounts. So now people outside the US, have to file annual reports about what kinds of bank accounts they have. And there's been this interplay between stopping crime, working with people the U.S. considers to be its enemy, someone who is subject to sanctions, and then also tax compliance. And all of these things go through the same people. Jim, how do you try to do all that stuff at once, particularly given that politics can change? And we've seen now in the U.S. a pullback from some of the reporting for all of these reasons that had been put in place.
Well, there's a lot of different things with that. But the first aspect that I'll just correct is the tax compliance, because tax compliance was one of the primary purposes of the original Money Laundering Act, the Currency and Financial Transactions Reporting Act, including the reporting of foreign bank accounts going back to 1972. And even in Germany, they amended their national law to include tax evasion as a predicate crime for money laundering back in 2010. So the aspect of tax considerations is now well embedded. And I think if anything, with debts and deficits likely to not go away as a major consideration, including for prosecutors within the U.S., even the framework for the Financial Intelligence Unit and the data until I built systems for the FIU were within the tax authority, the Internal Revenue Services. So they are more integrated than people would expect. And certain EU authorities like CEPLAC in Spain, they'll tell you that the tax information databases that they have are some of the most important for the anti-money laundering, because it's hard to explain. Someone who declares that they have an income of 20,000 euros a year can go and buy a Lamborghini for cash, which one of the obliged entities must report. So that's a little bit more a myth and misunderstanding than the practical aspect. In terms of the post 9/11 framework, now we're coming up on the 25th anniversary, so I'll be speaking among others involved in some of the changes at commemorative events. The biggest aspect there was, one, the movement to integrate counter-terrorist financing, which is quite different in a lot of ways, and we can dwell into that if you'd like, certainly in terms of risk-based values and volumes. It can take very little money to commit a terrorist attack. In the case of the 9/11 attacks, about $500,000 for drastic amount of deaths and disruption and damage, which might not even be significant enough for banks or a prosecutor to follow up in a fraud case or other aspects. It would be minor organized crime activity at that level. The one development that you flagged in the United States that has changed and has involved a change in policy view is the focus on beneficial owners of corporate entities. So again, I said from the very beginning, one of the fundamental premises of anti-money laundering requirements is know your customer. To put that in bank speak, if a bank is going to give you a loan, they will know everything about you. If you come and say, I would like to deposit cash or anything with a credit base, even if it's wired in, get a minimal amount of interest remuneration from you on a savings account, and you can make the net interest differential on loaning them out to someone, a bank has no commercial incentive to spend much time looking at you because they have no credit risk. What the Know Your Customer requirements are saying, the things that you know how to do on the lending side of your book, take a little time to figure out who the customer is moving cash or putting funds through your institution. That's essentially all that it is. It's not requiring banks to do something that they don't otherwise know what to do. And it's against that framework that the banks are struggling, because it's not a commercial incentive for them.
Yeah, I want to come back to the tax thing, because in my mind anyway, I was thinking about the cross-border implications of all of this. And in the U.S., I guess it would be just cross-jurisdiction, different states, different areas. In general, it's illegal to evade taxes or, you know, have a lot of unexplained income that you use to do things. But in the past there wasn't as much shared information. And so people did a better job of hiding that. And it seems like now with FATCA, the foreign account reporting requirement out of the US, it's encouraged the Europeans to start reporting bank account information to each other, not just domestically. And this has created more maybe of a culture of information sharing that now will reach a new level with AMLA. Is that a functional way to look at it? Or I'm sure I'm leaving lots out there too.
These aspects were actually very heavily debated from a policy matter in the early part of the global financial crisis, when aspects of financial fraud were exposed that essentially could be carried along on the books of financial institutions until they went under stress. Aspects of anti-corruption came to the fore, or corruption concerns. Aspects of stimulus measures and needing to spend funds at a level never done before, although in some cases surpassed with COVID measures a dozen years later. But the G20, so in terms of a global consensus, certainly European Union and the largest member states playing an active role in that, took the decisions, and hotly debated, that aspects of prudential supervision and safe banking oversight were correlated with anti-financial crime risks, at least in the negative sense, meaning that a bank that looked the other way to fraud, money laundering, corruption, tax evasion, moving through it, including offshore centers that had a part of their business model in supporting customers looking to be involved in any of those activities, that those institutions also tended to be more lax and riskier in terms of prudential supervisory oversight. And under times of stress, such as in the financial crisis, they had an opportunity to, or greater propensity to, fail. And that was the movement that essentially integrated anti-money laundering and other aspects into the lexicon and the public policy, not being kind of a side issue for law enforcement concern. That being said, the establishment of the single supervisory mechanism did not bring into the ECB's competence AML oversight. So that is the catch-up that we're doing now. You had a situation of the prudential supervision under a common rulebook, ECB direct supervision and lead over the other authorities, but now we're moving AML into a similar framework. But that policy principle was essentially established and adopted latest in the 2010 framework.
Nicola?
I want to stress the importance of the ECB in that story. The ECB has been the first and key advocate for the creation of AMLA. Actually, the story is that when ABLV, a Latvian bank, which was probably involved in some Russian business, was terminated, zapped out of existence by a letter from the US Treasury under the powers that were created after 9/11, that was in early 2018, it was the ECB who said openly what everybody could think: this is embarrassing. This shouldn't happen in Europe, and we need to do something about it. And they were the first to push for what became the creation of AMLA and the realization that the EU needed to step up its game in anti-money laundering, especially with the activities of Russia next door. I think that context is very important. It is also interesting that the ECB didn't claim that they should do it, at least for banks, despite the synergies with microprudential supervision that they do within the single supervisory mechanism. And I think here you have a pattern because, for example, when the EU decided to create a resolution authority for the Eurozone, the ECB also declined to take it for themselves. And that's why we have the single resolution board in Brussels. And similarly with anti-money laundering supervision of banks, the ECB didn't try to, you know, expand its empire. So I think it's interesting for the watchers of that system, many among us and probably in the audience, to see the ECB exercising that kind of restraint, even though the consequences that, at least for banks, that means several authorities to deal with and a bit of extra complexity. Of course, conversely, that means that AMLA will not do just banking, but can do all the scope of obliged entities, and that actually creates consistency and, to a certain extent, simplification.
To add the last aspects of that, also conduct. So consumer protection, conduct authorities tend not to be fully integrated within the framework of the SSM or other banking supervision in many.
And by the way, that's a major issue for the EU supervisory architecture, which is not getting enough attention, issues of consumer protection and the scope for fragmentation that comes from that. So very much connecting with the Letta report and that kind of thing. It is interesting, as Jim said, that we think of conduct of business supervision and prudential supervision as kind of separate domains, but they're actually very connected because when you are, for example, lousy on AML controls, that creates prudential financial stability risk. And there are many examples of that. So I think it is very important to think through the complexity of that interaction between conduct of business in the sense of consumer protection, financial integrity, like anti-money laundering, and financial risk, financial stability and prudential considerations.
I would very much like to take a couple of minutes to talk about sanctions and what they mean and how they interact with the financial system. So yes, Nicola, as you were.
I wonder, it's a question to Jim, actually, because in the U.S., there are two separate offices in the Treasury, the FinCEN, which Jim led, which the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which deals with anti-money laundering and combating the financing of terrorism. And then next door, there's the Office of Financial Assets Control, OFAC, which deals with sanctions, coordination, and formulation and enforcement. And in the creation of AMLA, there have been a number of key decisions. Creating a top European supervisor with direct supervisory authority for AML supervision, not making it a European FIU at this point because of the embeddedness of financial intelligence units with law enforcement, which remains national, and also, by the way, with intelligence communities and other aspects of the state that are at the national level. But then there is also the question of sanctions, because the EU is doing more and more financial sanctions, particularly since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia in February 2022. And actually, every other month, we hear of a new sanctions package with more people being designated and so on and so forth. So I'm very curious, the legislation creating AMLA doesn't give AMLA a big mandate on sanctions enforcement. So at this point, it's still, you know, sanctions. In practice, it's being drafted by the European Commission. The authority in charge in Brussels is technically the European External Action Service, but you can debate whether they have the right governance and tools for that. So I'm very curious about Jim's opinion on whether, you know, the next step is already to think about giving AMLA some sanctions competencies, or is that a bad idea? How do you think about that?
It's a very important question. But in order to break it down, you have to understand where there's similarities and overlap and where there's differences. So start with the differences. Fundamental policy difference. The aspects of sanctions in embargoes, it's a national security, war powers aspect, a fundamental political decision. When we talk about the history of the common market and the integration of the economic systems of France and Germany so that they would never fight wars after hundreds of years of fighting over resources and territory. Some of the story of Russian national gas is an aspect of binding Russia with almost endless natural resources into the needs for the European Union, and some thinking that that would prevent interests from diverging. We've seen that now that has gone in very different ways and has been extremely costly for the European Union and some member states, in particular Germany, in that regard. But the policy question as to whether we should prohibit the purchase of Russian gas or certain delivery mechanisms or certain financial institutions, the reason why it has ramped up is because it has not been a full-out embargo, such as in a wartime measure or something with very few jurisdictions, such as North Korea, where we say that we don't have any dealings with that institution. Fundamental policy measure, which can change. And part of the negotiations to either end the war in Ukraine or to end the fighting in Iran or to get them to not pursue nuclear weapons is all a question of, well, will we move these rules and these restrictions. So the the question of how to exercise and use national security embargoes and sanctions, fundamental policy choice, what's allowed, what's licensed, what's exceptions, which are the prohibited activities and prohibited entities. The flip side is from the practice area. If you're a financial institution and you're a corporate entity and you have certain provisions of working with them, how do you monitor for that? Well, the first thing is know your customer, including the beneficial owners and who's behind them. And the second is transaction monitoring of your activity. So you apply all of the anti-money laundering controls in processes in this essentially the same way that you would for your anti-money laundering role. So it's impossible for a bank to look at them separately in the daily processes. You could say something different in a mergers and acquisitions or if I'm doing investment advisory type work. But again, for most day-to-day aspects of financial transfers, it's the same process. So then we come back to the question of enforcement or penalizing, so a different use of the word sanctions. And we can say, well, did the bank allow a Russia-related transactions that is otherwise prohibited under the EU sanction regimes to go through? Did that happen because they had a failed monitoring system, which says that their monitoring system that's set up for AML and broader purposes does not work? Well, that's an oversight question, a structural problem, which would generally fall in the aspect of the financial supervisor. If instead they said, we know who the entity is, but we want to do business with them because they'll pay us a premium, well, that's a different policy aspect and subject to potential different enforcement regime and penalties in that regard. So that's where the aspects come in practice. From the bank side, the implementation, it's almost always going to be the case that there's a close coordination, if not a single reporting line as part of the anti-financial crimes compliance of the sanctions enforcement together with the anti-money laundering. We could talk more, but a segue if you want to now or later to the question of the penalty regime, a different aspect of the word sanctions for non-compliance with the overall anti-money laundering framework, because that's where the details and effectiveness are very important going forward.
Can you give us your quick take on that part of it?
Sure. So there's an aspect where if you look at the authorizing regulation, AMLA will have massive maximum penalty authorities tied to aspects of the amount of transactions at issue or up to, I believe it's 10% of the revenue of institution over the past year, something like we know, for instance, from GDPR with 4% of turnover. In practice, you've never seen penalties using those type of maximum authorities, but these are drastic potential for penalties. In practice, what I think is very important is among the many, there'll be a series of dozens of regulatory technical standards, some of which have been out for consultation and advanced stages, some yet to come from the AMLA, but the one draft still has to be approved through the formal processes with the European Commission and Parliament and the like, is what will be the penalty regime or the factors that go into the exercise of this strong authority from AMLA. And again, none of this should be particularly surprising because this is not something that doesn't already have decades of experience of member state supervisors, other frameworks for financial supervision that we've alluded to, as well as other countries around the world. But it'll get to the aspects of, is this a structural problem? Is this a repeat aspect? But the one that I think is extremely important and one that I looked closely at when I was imposing penalties under my own signature on financial institutions for the failure to follow through on the anti-money laundering obligations is whether it actually facilitated criminal activity. And there's a provision in the draft regulatory technical standards that says if it was actually involved in criminal activity, that brings it to the highest, most severe level. The question in practice is, how do you know that? Under the traditional aspect of bank supervision, the banks were very far, or I'm sorry, the competent authorities, the financial supervisors, were very far away from law enforcement in practice. And part of the reasons why banks would sometimes, rightly or wrongly, criticize the type of check-the-box process and concerns over effectiveness, saying this is technical standards, but we're worried about the real criminals. Well, only the law enforcement really knows about the real criminals, or there's a long lag time before you see what's going on. But AMLA could have insight through its FIU connections in a way that the banking supervisors will never necessarily know. That, I think, is critical going forward. And if you not only failed to implement the standards, maybe because you were cutting corners, trying to save money, and it turns out that a criminal group was able to abuse that process. Personally, I've always thought that that is something that should result in a higher penalty for your institution, because it's not just theoretical, but it's a practical aspect of a loss. And I'll just make one other comment on that and why it's so different mindset from what we often think of in some of the classic aspects of risks in prudential supervision, whether we talk about credit risk, market risk, aspects of intermediation, transformation of duration. Money laundering can be something that's very lucrative to the bank. Criminals will actually pay a premium for you to turn the other way or to set up shell companies and structures, and some measures up to 30% of the value of the underlying transactions. Imagine if you as a bank could charge 30% transaction fees on some of your activities. It's a pretty profitable margin. But if you don't understand the economic incentives, it's hard to understand why the banks struggle or would not implement some of these actions voluntarily absent a single rule book and significant follow-up and enforcement by the competent authorities.
Yeah, that's a whole extra incentive on top of just the general compliance burden of having to keep records and collect background information on people. We're coming up on the end of our time. Nicolas, going forward, what will you need to do to make this a success? So far, AMLA has kept a very low profile, not a lot of outward-facing announcements, pronouncements, but they have a big task ahead of them. Where do we go?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to conclude for now. AMLA has a huge set of challenges to address. They have started communicating a bit more in the last few weeks, actually. They had their inaugural conference in Frankfurt in early June, and that was kind of coming out of the secretive previous phase. AMLA currently has a bit under 200 staff. They aim at having 230 at the end of the year, 430 at the end of next year, in time for their assumption of direct authority. So that's a medium-sized organization. It is clear that they cannot succeed alone. AMLA is a hub of a very wide network of cooperation against financial crime, cooperation for financial integrity that includes the national authorities, that include law enforcement authorities and the national FIU, the Financial Intelligence Unit, that includes counterparts around the world, such as FinCEN, the treasury office that Tim used to head. And that includes, of course, the obliged entities, the banks and the other firms. So I think what will be fascinating to observe in the next few years, and in a way parallel to what we saw for the single supervisory mechanism a decade earlier, but also very different because of the different nature of the task, is the incentives. Who will have incentives to constructively engage with AMLA? Who will have incentive to resist this new player? How will AMLA react? How will they build channels and incentives for corporations? This will be really very fascinating to observe for analysts like us, and also hopefully with the possibility that they may indeed be successful at aligning the incentives to properly fight financial evasion, financial crime, and the subversion of our financial system by public and private enemies of the EU legal order.
Can I give you just that other concluding thing? So one, building upon what Nicola just said in terms of resources, AMLA's halfway to what I understand is their initial target of 430 staff. It's not really a lot when you look at the aspect of their responsibilities and the number of obliged entities across the EU, and setting up a transparent framework with consultation and justifying all of its measures under the public limelight. Resources will always be an issue. If you ask member states why they struggle with the application and implementation of the anti-money laundering framework, it's resources more than anything, by far. It's not that we don't know what to do and don't want to do better or don't want to bring more cases. It's resources. And to put that in context, the largest entities that you can guess today, notwithstanding the final list not being out, will be subject to direct AMLA oversight. I have a few thousand people working in their anti-money laundering office within one bank. And AMLA is going to have 430 people to oversee the entire European Union framework. That's not a lot of resources. The second aspect, just something that we haven't talked about, but it's important to put an understanding for those who are not experts in this area. The AML framework is essentially one of operational risk. The focus in recent years, cybersecurity, outsourcing oversight, third-party risk management, DORA, information and communications technology risk, now control of data, implementation of AI Act. The frameworks that banks are developing and banking supervisors are developing and implementing in those areas and struggling with it, right? DORA is supposed to be implemented, but there's virtually no institutions that are fully comfortable with that yet. That framework is much more akin to the anti-money laundering framework than traditional aspects of prudential supervision with respect to capital as it relates to credit risk, market risk, etc. So that we need to think about.
DORA, of course, the Digital Operational Resilience Act, which requires banks, insurers, and other financial groups to address their cyber risk. Cyber risk is a whole nother thing that we could do a whole other podcast on, and maybe we will. But in the meantime, for AMLA, I think we'll need to leave it there. I'm so grateful to both of you for coming on. Bruegel's Nicolas Véran, Jim Fries, veteran of the anti-money laundering and financial crime trenches. You can read their full bios and links to their publications on our website, Bruegel.org, where you can also find the archives of all of these podcasts. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thank you, and see you next time.